And our sermon text today is Job chapters 15 through 17. As we take up round two, Eliphaz. One of the major themes of this portion is, what does it mean to fear God? Now, the analogy often used is that of fearing one's father. And I think it can be appropriate. It can be a good thing or a bad thing, though, too. I had friends, relatives, and neighbors with all kinds of fathers. And I'm sure in this day and age, you are familiar with the same kind of thing. A father can be cruel and abusive, in which case he's not a good example of fearing God. My friend Randall, who lived on my block, genuinely feared his father because he was cruel and abusive. I once saw him mercilessly beat Randall when we were playing at his house. I was only 9 or 10 at the time. His father whipped him with his belt with a fierceness that terrified me. When he was finished, Randall was wailing in pain and fear. He looked at me with smoldering, angry eyes. I was scared he was going to do the same thing to me. I'll never forget that look. Randall feared his father and hated him too. In high school, I had another friend who had absolutely no fear of his father whatsoever. Steve regularly challenged authority, and he was well known in the principal's office and later to the local police. And he oscillated between a kind of taunting contempt and a benign indifference towards all those in authority. And when I finally met his father, I understood why. Steve's father was a milquetoast man who was afraid of fatherhood himself, had long ago abdicated his role to Steve's mother, who was a control freak herself. And I now know that Steve's behavior was a cry for someone to show him what limits were, what authority was, what the rules of manhood were. And he surely wasn't getting that from his dad. On the other hand, I had plenty of models of fatherhood where the true fear of the Lord was present. I've become more grateful for this over the years. My fathers, and I include my extended family, my uncles there as well, because they were very much a part of my discipline and upbringing. My fathers weren't perfect, but they did personify what it means to fear in a biblical sense. My fear of my father and my fathers consisted of a blend of love for my dad because he loved me and also a fright of discipline, good old-fashioned discipline. If I actually disobeyed him, I wanted to please him by obeying him, but I also rightly feared the spanking or restriction that might follow my disobedience. So we are capable of both of these responses, both of these feelings simultaneously. In fact, the model of the fear of God is precisely in this blend. Ralph Earle, a theologian, wrote an article on this for the Evangelical Dictionary of Theology, and he says the fear of the Lord does not mean being afraid, terrified of God per se. Rather, it is a reverential trust in God that makes us want to please and obey Him. And yet there is a wholesome feeling of being sure that we do not disobey or displease him, unquote. So behold the sense in which Job feared God. We're beginning to see this played out in Job's life, in addition to what God himself says about Job. Remember what God says, the text says 3 times about Job, just to make sure we get it. Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man who fears God, and turns away from evil. Now, not only is this truth challenged by Satan, that is, does Job fear God for naught? Remember, that is the question that triggers the entire patriarchal lawsuit. But not only is that challenged by Satan, but here and now by Eliphaz in his second speech. And it all passes for wisdom, too. Let us see the case now and how Job answers it. Now, you have an outline that was supplemented in your bulletin and a timely place for it because we are indeed continuing in part G, you see. I think it's G. I misplaced my outline, but I think it's G, where we are taking additional evidence, are we not, from the prosecution? And the unwittingly, these three men are witnesses for the prosecution. And that will extend all the way up to and through chapter 37. So, but it's good to bring our heads above water sometimes and just realize where we are in the patriarchal lawsuit. And we're now in round two of prosecutorial questioning by these three men. And Eliphaz leads it off in round two. So let us look at chapter 15. Here we go. We embark on this second round of cross-examination by the prosecution. And although masquerading as friends and colleagues in the study of wisdom, Job's three friends are in reality unwitting accomplices of Satan in charging Job with great evil. I'll get to reading the text here in just a moment. All of their understanding of wisdom is anchored in the law of lex talionis. You remember the idea of lex talionis. I'm going to keep using that phrase. You'll understand it by the time we're done with this. The idea of the law of retribution. That is, that a man gets what he deserves, that he reaps what he sows. If great righteousness, then he receives great blessing from God. If great evil, then he receives great cursing from God. And reasoning backwards from effect to cause, Job's friends deduce that his evil must be very great indeed, directly commensurate with a very great evil of his circumstances. And yet, as we have seen, Job's evil circumstances do not correspond to his standing before God. This causes great intellectual consternation on Job's part, great soul consternation, because God has already said that Job is a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. Why then the affliction? We know that it is a trial by ordeal by which Job will be proved to be either a man who fears God for naught, that is, even when all fleshly reason for doing so vanishes as it has, or he is a man who fears God for what he can get. That is a kind of quid pro quo. You do this for me, and I'll do this for you. You bless me, and I'll continue to be righteous and upstanding. If you do not, if you take this away from me, then I will, as my wife suggests, curse God and die. Which kind of man is he? As Job increasingly demonstrates that he does fear God out of love, faith, and fear, and refuses to repent, that is, he maintains the standing that God confesses him to be, blameless and upright, as he increasingly demonstrates himself to be that man, he becomes God's champion in this trial by ordeal, because God has staked his word on Job being blameless and upright. No need to confess. In fact, it would forfeit the trial if he did. So, by emerging not guilty in this patriarchal lawsuit, Job will become a type of Christ in the patriarchal period. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves because at this stage, that status is by no means settled. So, let us look at chapter 15, verses 1 to 6. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he argue in unprofitable talk or in words with which he can do no good? But you are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the craft. Your own mouth condemns you and not I. Your own lips testify against you." Well, as the divide grows between Job and his interlocutors, so does the rancor grow. Gone is all pretense of niceties, allowing the benefit of the doubt to Job. To Eliphaz, Job's belly is full of the east wind, which in that region is a scorching and dry wind, a deadly wind. Iniquity is his teacher, his tongue is crafty, and his own speech convicts him of sin. But the fatal blow, if landed on Job, is central to the thesis of the lawsuit. You are doing away with the fear of God and hindering meditation before God, which in Hebrew poetry is a parallelism. This is an insight into part of what the fear of God consists. That is, this is a constituent element of what it means to fear God. Hindering meditation before God. Meditation before God is indeed a part and parcel of the fear of God. The King James puts it, you restrain prayer before God. Also a good translation. Verses 7 to 16, chapter 15. Are you the first man who was born? Or were you brought forth before the hills? Have you listened in the counsel of God? And do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not clear to us? Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, older than your father. Are the comforts of God too small for you, or the words that deal gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away, and why do your eyes flash that you turn your spirit against God and bring such words out of your mouth? What is man that he can be pure? Or who is born of a woman that can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water? Now, once again, Eliphaz makes an appeal to authority. That is the aged, the established course of wisdom from before the hills were brought forth, right? That resided with the gray-haired and aged and is now resident with us, of course. And note the ironic allusion to the prologue, too. Triple irony here. Have you listened in the counsel of God in verse 8? Of course, Job hasn't been privy to the proceedings of the sons of God, right? That we saw in the prologue. That's the point. Otherwise, he would be stoic. He'd keep a good stiff upper lip and bear his sufferings, knowing God would eventually restore him manyfold, and Satan would have made his point. Forfeited the lawsuit in the process. But the double irony is that neither has Eliphaz, Bildad, or Zophar listened in the counsel of God either, have they? They haven't understood that the great drama of a patriarchal lawsuit is unfolding even as they are speaking, a trial by ordeal, by which it will be proved or no that Job serves God for naught. The triple irony is that we have listened in the counsel of God, haven't we? We have been privy to all this crucial information in the prologue. This triple irony brings a burden and responsibility to us because we do have this information. This is wisdom literature, and if we are going to be wise ourselves, then we must bring this information to the text as we are reading and thus become wiser ourselves. That is the burden and responsibility of reading this text with the prior information of the prologue. And you must do this. Well, also, once more, we come to understand with Job and his friends that God is intrinsically holy and righteous, too, in these latter verses. God is intrinsically holy and righteous by nature, transcendent far above all that he has created, while all other creatures fall immeasurably short. What is man that he can be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he can be righteous? Behold, God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. How much less one who is abominable and corrupt, a man who drinks injustice like water. Who do you think Eliphaz has in mind in that category? This is solid truth that Eliphaz is articulating here. As we have found time and again throughout the book of Job, and will continue to discover, a great truth is articulated eloquently in the best tradition of wisdom, but with utterly no application to Job's situation. This is where wisdom on our part comes in. We have to understand this and apply the prologue to our understanding of the rest of the text. That's where the wheels start turning and the smoke starts generating out your ears as you try to put this all together, okay? You have a responsibility to bring wisdom and be wiser yourself by the time you're done with this text. What we have here is a classic case of right truth, wrong man. Job has bridged the great existential gulf with God and creature by availing himself of the means of grace. We've seen in the prologue, he faithfully sacrifices on behalf of himself and his children, lest they have cursed God in their heart, right? And by prayer, by meditation, we've seen that's part of the fear of God as well. By these things, Job humbly confesses that he is not abominable and corrupt, drinking injustice like water, as Eliphaz implies. Okay, verses 17 to 35, chapter 15. I will show you, hear me, and what I have seen I will declare. What wise men have told, without hiding it from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given. And no stranger passed among them. The wicked man writhes in pain all his days, through all the years that are laid up for the ruthless. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer will come upon him. He does not believe that he will return out of darkness, and he is marked for the sword. He wanders abroad for bread, saying, "Where is it?" He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. Distress and anguish terrify him. They prevail against him like a king ready for battle. Because he has stretched out his hand against God and defies the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with a thickly bossed shield. Because he has covered his face with his fat and gathered fat upon his waist and has lived in desolate cities and houses that none should inhabit, which were ready to become heaps of ruins. He will not be rich, and his wealth will not endure, nor will his possessions spread over the earth. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry up his shoots. By the breath of his mouth he will depart. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself, for emptiness will be his payment. It will be paid in full before his time, and his branch will not be green. He will shake off his unripe grape like the vine and cast off his blossom like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of bribery. They can see trouble and give birth to evil, and their womb prepares deceit. Now here, with great eloquence, Eliphaz lays out the ultimate fate of the wicked. The ultimate fate of the wicked. Many parallel scriptures in the wisdom literature and the New Testament for that matter. Although the wicked may flourish for a time, that's the sense of he has covered his face with his fat and gathered fat upon his waist. In the ancient world, fat was a sign of prosperity. That means you had enough and excess over necessity that you were fat, if you will. But it will not endure. God will bring the wicked into judgment. He says, for the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of bribery. They conceive trouble and give birth to evil, and their womb prepares deceit. Once again, implicating Job. Job, this is your life, right? Eliphaz is saying, look what has happened to you. Once again, a great truth, wrong man. How does Job answer this, now laid once again at his feet? let us turn to chapter 16, where Job begins his response. Doth Job fear God for naught? Doth Job fear God at all? Eliphaz is saying, you have besmirched the fear of God. Point two, then. Once again, we're in round two. And Eliphaz is speaking. And point two, chapter 16, the fear of God is central to Job's integrity, on behalf of which, that is his integrity, Job appeals to his witness in heaven. Chapter 16. First of all, verses 1 through 5, chapter 16. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall windy words have an end, or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do if you were in my place. I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the soleness of my lips would assuage your pain. Job's patience is wearing thin. The patience of Job we often talk about, right? It's wearing a little thin now as he points out, once again, right truth, wrong man, guys. I've heard many such things. I could also speak as you do if you were in my place. I could join words together against you and shake my head against you. The glib and easy critique of his situation without any thought or consideration of what Job has been articulating. Remember, Job is struggling. Job is being refined by his suffering. He's coming gradually and slowly to redemptive conclusions, right and left. We're going to see one more yet again today. And these guys are left in the dust. They aren't listening. They just keep churning out glib and easy critiques based on old wisdom formulas. They have had no thought or consideration of what Job has been articulating. And what they're giving him is a cure that exacerbates his illness, a comfort of misery. Miserable comforters are you all. Verses 6 through 17. If I speak, my pain is not assuaged. If I forbear, how much of it leaves me? Surely now God has worn me out. He has made desolate all my company. And he has shriveled me up, which is a witness against me. And my leanness has risen up against me. It testifies to my face. He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He has gnashed his teeth at me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. Men have gaped at me with their mouth. They have struck me insolently on the cheek. They mass themselves together against me. God gives me up to the ungodly and casts me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, and he broke me apart. He seized me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. He set me up as his targets, his archers surround me. He slashes open my kidneys and does not spare. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with breach upon breach. He runs upon me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and have laid my strength in the dust. My face is red with weeping, and on my eyelids is deep darkness. Although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. You know people who have suffered like this, huh? I have. I have not suffered like this, but I know people who have. My face is red with weeping, and my eyelids is deep darkness. Job really does resonate with those who suffer. This is a book, once again, for not for armchair sufferers, but for wheelchair sufferers. Job not only gives eloquent voice to his suffering and consequently then to the suffering of others, but Job also gives eloquent voice to the very meaning of his name, enemy. Remember, we see that Job's very name, Yob, that's the word that's used here, Hebrew word that's used here, with no little irony, right? He He gives eloquent voice to this meaning of his name, enemy, doesn't he? All through these verses, and how God feels, and how he feels that God has attacked him, coming upon him with great fury. He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. Who is his adversary? A little ambiguous to him, right? Of course, Satan is his adversary. The very name Satan in Hebrew is adversary. That's the word that's used here. But also he feels that God is his adversary as well. And God is his adversary here in a manner of speaking, is he not? As he tests Job here in this trial by combat. My adversary sharpens his eyes against me. There's a dual sense in which we have both Satan and God as Job's adversary, and Job being an enemy to both of them as well. He set me as his target. His archers surround me. He runs upon me like a warrior. Once more, Job concludes here with great perplexity, the great perplexity that he feels over all of this frontal assault by God. Although there is no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure, he's maintaining his own integrity and righteousness here, right? Rightly so. Once again, God's champion, because that's what God has said about him. Job refuses to relent. Now also here, Job, and this is crucial to understanding Job's growth. Job is increasingly aware of the disproportion between his status, which is blameless and upright, and his stature. That is, he's treated all but evil and unrighteous, isn't he? Job is increasingly aware of this disproportion, and his friends are not solving that disproportion for him. He must seek it elsewhere. Why this disproportion? He's, through his suffering, he is coming to hard conclusions, difficult conclusions, but right conclusions, conclusions of redemptive history. He's seeing increasingly there is no congruity between these two, between his status and his stature. What gives? Verses 18 to 22 then. O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eye pours out tears to God that he would argue the case of a man with God, as a son of man does with his neighbor. For when a few years have come, I shall go the way from which I shall not return. You hear the urgency there in Job's voice? Now notice the subtle contrast and growth here. But Job in his wisdom, Job is coming to wisdom, genuine biblical wisdom here. What Job in his wisdom now sees is spoken with a certainty not previously seen. He says, even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high. Now we've seen previously yearnings for and anticipations of an intercessor. Yearnings for, anticipations of a mediator. A go-between for Job and God. Wistful they were, right, in other chapters? But they've been tentative and hesitant. This revelation is bold and certain. What was once aspiration is now assertion. And it is relentless and untiring. O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Right? Until it lodges with God. My eye pours out tears to God that he would argue the case of a man with God. Now, Job has found a theme here. He will not quit. He seized upon a mode of redemption from his suffering, and he's going to amplify it for the remainder of his trial. From here on, Job is a pit bull of intercession. He's got a death grip on getting one. His time is short. He must find a way to argue the case of a man with God. That is, participate in a patriarchal lawsuit with God. See, he's finding his way, wrestling his way to this. Not an easy conclusion to come to, but he's coming to it. He realizes he must find a way to argue the case of a man with God. Participate in a patriarchal lawsuit. Oh, if he could only have one. If he could only have a patriarchal lawsuit with God. Even as a son of man does with his neighbor. Right? As if to say, well, that's it. That's what I need, is a lawsuit to vindicate my name. But I can't go up against God by myself. He's already established that too, right? Voila! Do you see Job's true wisdom here versus the false wisdom of his friends? Job has stumbled upon the very course of the actual proceedings transpiring before the sons of God in the heavenly council. Stumbled on this, right? What a coincidence, huh? There is a patriarchal lawsuit in process, even as Job utters these words. Those words cry out for a patriarchal lawsuit, replete with counsel. He's calling out for the very thing he's in the midst of. He doesn't know it. Do you feel the poignant irony of this situation? Doesn't it make you want to cry? Job is a passionate book on human suffering. You just want to say, Job, if I could only tell you, buddy. But we can't, can we? But we certainly can feel for him and feel for those who suffer then consequently too. Because there are reasons and purposes for suffering. Those reasons and purposes for which are not revealed to the sufferer or those around him so often, right? And that's the case here. So understand that Job is growing. He's maturing in wisdom at a terrible cost. He's that chick cracking the shell like we talked about last week. Laboring, working with all his might and main. He's that caterpillar breaking through the chrysalis as a butterfly. But you must see the beautiful redemptive irony of Job. The beautiful redemptive irony of Job. Do you see how he anticipates our counsel before God? For there is one God, as Paul says, and there is one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. Anticipated here in Job. This is why he's leaving those three friends in the dust. He doesn't need their wisdom. In fact, it's not wisdom, is it, in this case? But we must also see the redemptive solution to righteous suffering here too. That is for those who suffer, others who suffer as well. Because Job's solution is their solution too. Trusting in God, growing, maturing, learning obedience through suffering, as the author of Hebrews says. We can't go through that with those who suffer. We can give them the counsel of Job, however. Trust in God, because there are reasons perhaps for your suffering, purposes for your suffering that you don't know about nor ever will know about until glory. These are the kinds of things we bring comfort to those who suffer. Not bromides, not stiff upper lip. God really does love you. You'll get through this. All those things that just wash off the back like water off a duck for those who suffer. But there is real solution, then, real peace, real comfort that we can bring to sufferers. But we must always understand the counsel of Job in it. But Job is not out of the woods yet. We see in chapter 17 then that he is yet searching for another theme, the theme of hope. Let's look to then point 3, chapter 17. Once again, we're in round number 2 now. We're seeing Job slowly, painfully come to true wisdom. Round number 2 with Eliphaz. The fear of God is central to Job's integrity, his suffering for which, that is, suffering for his integrity, tests the boundaries of hope in the future. Chapter 17, verses 1 through 5. My spirit is broken. My days are extinct. The graveyard is ready for me. Surely there are mockers about me, and my eye dwells on their provocation. Lay down a pledge for me with you. Who is there who will put up security for me? Since you have closed their hearts to understanding, therefore you will not let them triumph. He who informs against his friends to get a share of their property, the eyes of his children will fail. So after rising to those heights, Job now sinks into despair, despair of hope. Verses 1 through 5, Job scavenges around for a morsel of hope, but doesn't find much. Once again, this will become another motif that's going to blossom and grow, another motif in the midst of his suffering. Whence hope? The graveyard is ready for me. And like those surrounding Christ at his crucifixion, Job is surrounded by mockers. And so dicey is Job's situation that he doesn't think anyone would risk going bond for his redemption. Lay down a pledge, put up security. Any hands? Crickets, right? Instead, the very ones who should be doing that is giving and hoping and trusting, are behaving like vultures wanting to pounce on his property. Rather taking and distrusting, right? That's who he's surrounded by. Whence hope? Once again, he's to be part of his breaking out of his shell, part of cracking that chrysalis. Verses 6 to 16, then, of chapter 17. He has made me a byword of the peoples, and I am one before whom men spit. My eye has grown dim from vexation, and all my members are like a shadow. The upright are appalled at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the godless. Yet the righteous holds to his way, and he who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger. But you, come on again, all of you, and I shall not find a wise man among you. My days are past, my plans are broken off, the desires of my heart. They make night into day. The light, they say, is near to the darkness. If I hope for Sheol as my house, if I make my bed in darkness, if I say to the pit, you are my father, and to the worm, my mother or my sister, where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars of Sheol? Shall we descend together into the dust? You see his despair. But even in the face of all this disproportionate suffering and despair, which he so eloquently articulates, doesn't he, for all those who suffer, there are those who get it. He says, the righteous are appalled at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the godless. But it's not enough. You have to come to what he is coming to in terms of hope, in terms of resurrection, in terms of mediators. Because Job also reflects upon his own growth in grace and the obedience and maturity and wisdom that suffering has wrought in him. He says, yet the righteous holds to his way. I.e. me. I hold to my way. I know my way is true. I'm breaking through my shell, through my chrysalis, through my eggshell, and I'm growing in wisdom, and you are not. He who has clean hands grows stronger and stronger, i.e. me, Job. I am God's champion here. I am growing in grace and strength, not you. No thanks to you, friends. But he still does not see his way to hope. Whence hope? He closes with an extended conditional sentence. You remember what conditional sentences are. If something obtains and holds true, then we can conclude, right? If, then, construction. An extended, complex, conditional sentence that leaves answerless, at least for now, whether there's hope for him or not. Is there hope for me? It's answerless right now. If his situation is as desperate as it seems, that is, Sheol is my house, darkness is my bed, the pit and the worm are my parents or sibling, right? If things are as bad as all that, then where precisely is there room for hope? A question asked in despair and hopelessness. Now that question then, that conditional sentence question, is left hanging in midair, so to speak, for now. But the motif is established. The motif of whence hope has been set in motion too. One of the three or four that we already have in motion, okay? So keep that in mind. File that, because we'll come back to it. So behold Job's steadfast fear of God. He is not compromising the fear of God. In fact, he's growing and flourishing and maturing the fear of God in his own life, isn't he? As he continues to grow, as suffering continues to refine him, and it is nurturing in him, then the suffering is nurturing in him wisdom and salvation. Wisdom and salvation for Job. And Job being, for the patriarchal period, indeed this model of redemption and of wisdom. Well, let us now then come to that place where we find wisdom and salvation, emblemized in the body and blood of Christ, to whom Job points, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.